Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Marcus Higby.
On today's show, we welcome back foreign affairs specialist, best-selling author, and we are very lucky to say Monocle 24 regular, Tim Marshall. He'll be discussing his latest book, Divided, Why We Are Living in an Age of Wars.
And we'll be hearing from artist Leonor Antunes, whose work reflects on our sense of time, place, and the timeline of making art itself. She'll be discussing her new show, A Thousand Realities from an Original Mark, later.
And we'll be unearthing the lesser-told stories of the music composed for TV shows with author and curator David Hollander. He'll take us through his new book, Unusual Sounds, the hidden history of library music, at the end of the show.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Fernando Gustavo will be looking ahead to next week's news, and we'll play some good music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Happy Sunday, Tom Edwards. How are you doing this weekend?
Always a pleasure to spend my Sunday lunchtime with you, Marcus. What a week it's been. A veritable hive of activity here at Midori House. All sorts of products cranking through the production line. Quite the setup.
Absolutely. It's been the production week for the July-August issue of Monocle magazine. Obviously, people are also busy with the Spring Weekly and many, many other projects as well. Obviously, I'm busy with the menu, I'm busy with all these shows I do and all that. What do you do?
Never a dull moment. Well, one thing I've been doing this week is marvelling at the British summertime. I use the phrase loosely. It's been, as it's been, I think, across, well, globally, but certainly across Western Europe, very stormy, very turbulent at times.
It's been very, I kind of feel like I miss cooler weather, being Nordic. I think it's quite funny, by the way, when you talk about the summer, because you just don't look like you enjoy summer that much. I've never seen you wear shorts in my life, and I've known you for almost 7 years, Tom Edwards.
A, it's only 6 years. B, you only ever see me in the office, and we've been through this before. We're not going to get into this, especially with Fernando just around the corner. But
oh, we've done this before.
I don't consider shorts appropriate workwear. But no, hasn't it been extraordinarily turbulent? Thunder and lightning, a couple of nights during the past week, It's just thunder, constant thunderstorm, broiling thunderstorm for sort of 4 or 5 hours.
I have never seen this at like anything like this before in this country.
It's like the tropics.
It's like in the tropics, absolutely. And it's also, it kind of limits your life because I'm still not used to how quickly the weather can change in London. So I would leave home in the morning with no umbrella, just wearing a T-shirt. And then I basically could not leave the office for 4 hours, 5 hours, because it would be raining. Thanks for that umbrella you actually lent me one day, by the way. So I was able to go and get my lunch.
An absolute pleasure, of course, Marcus. Well, look, we're talking about turbulent times, thunder and lightning and all the rest. Shall we spread a positive ray of radio sunshine into the studio next?
Let's invite Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco in.
There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me, for liberty, Fernando.
A warm welcome to you, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, soberly attired in a... Not a sunshine-coloured garment today.
A navy polo, in a way. But guys, I was a bit inspired by what you're saying about thunder and lightning. Can I quote a former Russian Eurovision entry? That's the lyrics of his very good pop song.
I think Tom made that reference on purpose.
Well, I think he did, because the track goes like this. Thunder and lightning, it's getting exciting.
There you go.
That's amazing.
I think it's a good pop refrain.
What's the famous prize for best song lyrics writing?
The Ivor Novello Awards, I think, right?
Surely. I think, come on. Winging its way.
Yes.
What, Thunder and Lightning, very, very frightening. Is that in Bohemian Rhapsody as well?
Perhaps.
I think. No? Anyone? No advances on that.
It's a good lyric anyway.
Faye, what, talking of the weather in terms of the political, geopolitical week ahead. Sunshine, showers, what's on the horizon?
I don't see sunshine, Tom, but you know, next week it's, well, this upcoming week. It's the G7 summit.
In
Canada, exactly. And I think things can be a bit awkward in a way because, you know, one of the main themes this year is advancing gender equality and working on climate change. But from the news that we have already, of course, President Trump, I think he's not agreeing with some of those elements. So to be honest, I think it would be very difficult to, you know, because they usually have a document at the end of the summit saying what did they manage to achieve. But I think this year will be quite a tough one as well. And let's also remember that Italy, I mean, at the moment they have, an interim prime minister, Carlo Cottarelli. So, you know, they also have been living through turbulent times. So I would not say it would be the smoothest of the G7 summits. But I do like the pictures they take there with all the leaders. You see who is controlling the world at the moment.
Absolutely. And at the same time, considering all this turbulence and all those tensions, it will definitely be interesting to see what's happening over there. So I would imagine that we get a fair amount of news from Quebec.
And I want more pictures of Macron and Trudeau together as well, like we had last year as well.
Bromance.
A very nice
bromance in the air. What else is in the air this week ahead, Fernando?
Well, today is actually the Gay Pride in São Paulo. And I chose the topic, you know, first of all, it's the biggest gay pride in the world. But for the first time, I may say, well, there's always been some political elements. But this year, the main theme there is our vote, our voice. Because, you know, it's an election year in Brazil. And, you know, the country is divided. We have, you know, far-right candidates. You know, at the same time that we have more gay rights, there's been more anti gay right politicians as well. So I think this time they've been very clear. I think it'll be less carnivalesque and I think it'll be more about politics, a bit more serious. But nevertheless, it brings business to the city. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the Gay Pride and the Formula One event are the two big events of the city of São Paulo, which hosts many, many events.
Exactly. And you say this is the biggest pride event in the world. How many people are attending? Do you have any idea of the figures?
Yeah, of course, every year changes, but I think the record was about 2.5 million people.
Wow.
And you know, I've been to one. I couldn't stay in the middle because, you know, I don't like too much crowds. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it is basically the main street of São Paulo. It's like if Oxford Street closed down, full of people dressed in different costumes.
And what happens after that? What are these 2.5 million people up to, Fernando?
Well, you know, they go dance later. But I have to say it's a very family-oriented event as well. There's a lot of, you know, non-gay people as well that goes. But I wonder, which costume would you guys choose? You know, I have one in mind.
I don't know.
You know, I think, you know, I would like to dress as a kind of a bitchy, chic old lady with a cigarette, you know. So, perhaps.
How are you meant to dress up for a pride event?
The way you want, Marcus, you know.
Just let it all hang out.
Exactly.
I may just dress up wearing something quite casual and relaxed.
That's beautiful.
What about you, Tom?
Sorry, I'm just rendered almost speechless by developments here in Studio One. Fernando, perhaps we should move on.
Let's move on now. Let's talk about film. You know, it's official, the start of the summer season. You know, I chose a few topics because, you know, guys, we live busy lives, sometimes a bit stressful. And I do like the films that make you forget about that. Cheesy films, basically, with a good script, okay? Not talking about horrible films. But so this year, there's quite a few. So on the 8th of June, Ocean's 8 will be released in the cinema, which is, you know, it was based on the Ocean's 12 with George Clooney. And it's a group of women. They're planning a heist on the Met Gala in New York. But look at the cast. Sandra Bullock, Kate Blanchett, Brianna, you know, Sarah Paulson, Elena Bonham Carter, and, you know, and much more. I think it would be a very, very fun film, and I look forward to see that. But do you want a little bit more cheesy films for the summer?
Yes, please.
One that I look forward to is to see The Meg, which is about the 75-foot megalodon and the shark, you know, the prehistoric shark. I've seen the film. What I like about it, they make fun of it. You know, they're not taking themselves too seriously. So, of course, there's a giant shark eating mm-hmm. people. But I think, to be honest, that's what I want to see in the summer as well. So there's also Crazy Rich Asians, which is a romantic comedy, you know, with an all-Asian cast, which is remarkable. It's going to be a big blockbuster. So, again, we're seeing more films with minority-led and female roles. I mean, they're basically dominating the summer, which is, I think, is good news.
Well, let's hope the weather matches up. We started off by talking about the weather.
And Mamma Mia, Here You Go Again. Not forgetting that one, the most important.
How could we forget that, Fernando?
Thank you very much.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thanks for being with us.
We're speaking to Tim Marshall in just a moment.
One of the more troubling developments in global politics in recent years, and there's truly an embarrassment of riches to be choosing from, is the recent return of separatism and an us-and-them mentality in mainstream thinking. It can be seen in examples ranging from the UK's logic-defying Brexit vote to Donald Trump's pledge to build a wall between the US and Mexico. People are putting up barriers, even though history has shown they rarely do any good.
And half of all the border barriers built since the end of the Second World War have been constructed in the 21st century. That is just one of the points highlighted in journalist Tim Marshall's new book, Divided, Why We Are Living in an Age of Walls. And he joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Tim.
Thank you.
So what is happening now? Why do we see now more walls than ever before?
I think it's because rise of nationalism. What is that driven by? Mass movement of peoples. Put onto that the rise of technology, allowing people to move. Add on the 2008 crash, where there's less money around, which also can drive nationalism. And what you have is fence and wall building at a scale I don't think most people know is going on. I mean, you've highlighted Trump's wall, and it does get all the headlines, and it is symbolic of the us and them. But India has fenced off the entirety of Bangladesh. Iran has fenced off Pakistan. All through Europe, Serbia, Hungary, Croatia, the walls have gone up. Kenya is fencing off Somalia. Saudi Arabia has fenced off Iraq, etc.
And Tim, I guess we've seen this acceleration in the process. And as you mentioned there, some of the examples that people are most familiar with. But I guess part of me would think, well, that just demonstrates that wherever you go, whatever the era, whatever the political development, people kind of enjoy doing this. And us and them, in one way of speaking or another, has always endured, of course. It's what defines peoples of whatever nationhood. Is there a degree to which this is something that is, if not innate, a tendency humans have long had?
Yes. And I'm glad you put it so succinctly, because I think there's an awful lot of people, especially in liberal intelligentsia, are frightened to admit that. Frightened to admit that we are, at base, animals. Animals able to rise above just being animals and to think and create and build bridges. But we are animals. We do like our space. We always have. Ever since we stopped being hunter-gatherers, at that point we started to build walls. And we always have done. But there was, after the Second World War, especially in Europe, but elsewhere, an awful lot of things going on which were people coming together. NAFTA, United States, Mexico, Canada, Mercosur in the Latin America, the EU, ASEAN in the Far East, etc., etc. And these multinational and global organizations coming together. And a lot of walls came down. But what appears to have happened this century is, because of the reasons we've given, driven by nationalism, they've gone back up. 65 countries, that's more than a third of all nation states, wall or fence themselves off from their neighbours.
Tim, do you think any of these walls are actually, what would they call them, good walls?
Every story has two sides, and every wall has two sides. You said at the beginning that they often don't work, and I think that's correct, but they sometimes do work. I'll give you one from the past. Constantinople, the walls stood for 1,000 years before they were breached, and every single generation in that 1,000 years was glad and thought they were a good wall protecting them. Bang up to date, and much more contentious, the Israeli wall on the West Bank with Palestine. I've got friends on both sides, and one side tells me about how their land has been appropriated, how their olive trees are cut down, and how if they protest, they risk their life and limb, families cut off, unable to get to work. And all that is true, consequently, a bad wall. And then you go to the other side, and some Israelis will say to you, look at the figures of suicide bombings in the years before the wall went up, look at it afterwards, hundreds and hundreds of lives saved, good wall. So it does depend on your perspective.
And indeed, what's the perspective like, I guess, from atop one of these walls? Tim, if we look at the big picture, lots of talk, that, and there's a narrative as well, not just about wall and fence building, but about globalism, globalization, and the challenges for the one which I guess is more aspirational, the one which is more of a sort of a political ideology. Are they both or either, particularly globalization? I mean, is it in crisis? And does your book reflect, are the reasons behind the building of the walls and the crisis in globalization similar or the same?
Well, they are definitely connected. For example, Mr. Trump's wall. If you are a white or a blue-collar worker in America, many of the industries, your salary is only two-thirds of what it was, in real terms, of your mother and father's salary 20, 30 years ago. And globalization is one of the reasons. There's more competition in the world. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. But if you're one of those people that has been sideblinded by it, you might think, I don't like this. I want protectionism. I want nationalism. I don't want people coming in to compete with my for my job. Hence, psychologically, a bloke comes along and says, build that wall, and he gets a lot of votes. I know that that one's not going to work, but psychologically, it makes people feel better. And I think that is directly connected to globalization. Because when things are working and when the money's being spread around, you accept it. When the money runs out, and I really think the 2008 crash has got a lot to do with this, when the money starts to run out, you start to turn inward. Simultaneously, you've got this mass movement of peoples, and people retreat into identity. And again, liberal intelligentsia sort of sneers at identity, but that's because they're usually the last people to be affected, and so they can hang on to their globalist anywhere identity, whereas people who are suffering are pulled back into their identities. I mean, I'm not saying that it's always healthy, but I think people should be slightly more perhaps understanding of the people retreating into their identity.
But do you think we will see that change at some point? Do you think in the future less walls are going to be built?
I'd like to think so. Not convinced. I mean, other than the Berlin Wall, you tell me a wall that's come down in the past 30 years. None, but an awful lot have gone up. Well, actually, I mean, it's slightly flippant. I say it in the book. If Mars attacks, at that point, there's one us and there's them. At that point, we'll come together. But other than that, no, I mean, the book is slightly philosophical in that it does take a position on human nature, and that is that we actually, many of us, quite like our divisions. You know, we like that the wine is better here, the food is better there, our language is beautiful. You know, we actually do like that. It's when it spills over into aggressive nationalism that it becomes very problematic. I mean, there is a wall in every chapter, but the book's not called Walls, it's called Divided, because the walls are the vehicle to explain A, these physical divisions, but also what I also think is happening with social media. We have divided into cyber tribes screaming at each other across the divide. Mark Zuckerberg has even accepted that he got it wrong. He hasn't brought the world closer together. Politics, I think, is divided. It's going to the extremes. And so I think we are living in this time where after 70 years post-Second World War, where the movement was one way, we are now in danger of stalling.
Tim, I don't know, there's some sort of sobering aspects of this, and the picture looking forwards is, if not necessarily bleak, it's hard to find the dappled light ahead. There was an astonishing big op-ed, sort of exploratory piece in the New York Times, I think it was this week, about why Britain is looking more like America and less like Europe for the first time in several generations, and that's no good thing. One would be forgiven for thinking that everything's bad and set to get worse reading some of your books. No, I don't mean that you bear any personal responsibility, but give us some optimism to cling on to.
You're right. I mean, I do tend to write about problems, and that's the, you know, it's easy, isn't it, for journalists? We only have to describe problems. We don't have to have the brain power to solve them. It's slightly a warning, the book, to say that we are in danger of stalling. I'm not saying we're going back into reverse and into the caves, but we are in danger of stalling. I try to end on a positive note that we certainly need a massive redistribution of wealth around the world. And there's a phrase I've got that if we don't move more money to where most of the people are, many of them are going to move to where the money is. And that will upset the politics. We've seen that in the rise of the right wing in Europe. On the positive side, I do believe that we're probably better off now than we ever have been. And that's true of many, many parts of the world. I do say in like a paragraph, death rates in childbirth down, education rates up, diseases being eradicated. But of course, if you've got a whole book about division, a few paragraphs about how actually things are quite good, they're not going to make as much impact. But it is precisely because I do believe in the possibility of humankind to come together, to have the brain power to share, because that's what it's all about, that I'm writing that at the moment we appear to be stalling in what I hope is an onward trajectory towards unity, which sounds a little bit like a hippie, but we do have one with us, Marcus.
Absolutely. And I was just saying that you are the newsman. You have been following all these borders, among many other things, for many, many years. What kind of research did you conduct for this book?
Well, I went to the Great Wall of China. That helps. I went to a lot of the walls. You know, I mean, I went up to Hadrian's Wall in Scotland. I went to the Great Wall of China.
What did you see? What did you experience?
The Great Wall of China, for example, in an instant getting up there, I felt I now understand China better. I'm not an expert. I'm not claiming that. But you go to places around the world and you see the tallest building in the world and it's, oh, well, you know, it's astonishing. Or you go to the Grand Canyon and you're full of awe. In the instant I saw the Great Wall of China, I suddenly internalized and understood so much better this Chinese concept of us and them, the barbarian on one side, the civilized world on the other. And to see it laid out there, knowing that it goes on for thousands of miles, was quite something. And I've been down to one or two of the walls and fences in Europe, which again are stark examples of how many, many Europeans are thinking that their livelihood and their identities are in danger. And many Europeans are happy to have these fences. It's an unpalatable truth. Look at Hungary. They've got a lot of fences. They just re-elected the government with an overwhelming majority.
And Tim, just on that point, we talk often about the political classes, the diplomatic classes, I suppose, as well. What about that? There's a stalling in the, to my mind, in the process of the development of the political classes. Certainly here in the UK, you look stateside the same. All across Western Europe, we see some of these characters who are undesirable at best, reprehensible at worst. Could we see, or do we need to see, a return of some charismatic, younger, dynamic politicians? Maybe the kind of people with both the bravery and the smarts that you just were talking about to actually address some of these very immediate challenges?
I think we do, and we need people to be able to explain that trade is a good thing, that protectionism is a bad thing, but also that an overt identification with your own ethnicity or nationality is a very dangerous thing, and explain these examples. I mean, when David Cameron, the former British Prime Minister, ahead of the Brexit vote, said what we're actually talking about here is stability and possibly trying to damp down the possibility of conflict in Europe, he was laughed at. But in fact, that is part of what it's about. Those are the stakes that everybody is playing for way down the line. You mentioned this young charismatic, and I immediately thought of Macron. And he does put this very well, this vision of the open society as opposed to the closed version. And he is the one who's trying to bring Europe together, but he's bumping up hard against economics and Mrs. Merkel in Germany, who thinks, I'm not going to fund your ideas. And also, this is the warning of the book about the problems of divisions. If you don't know that they're happening and don't accept them, you can't combat them. Le Pen last year got 34%. She was smashed by Macron. But the narrative was the far right has been pushed back. And I take the completely different view. She doubled the vote that her dad got in 2002 from 17% to 34%. Europe is not pushing back against the far right because Europe is more divided now than it has been for decades.
Now, finally, Tim, you say that we are living in an age of walls. Do you think Donald Trump's wall will ever happen?
No, I don't. Less reported is the fact that Mexico and the United States have a treaty. You cannot build on the Rio Grande floodplain. Well, you know, even if he wants to, he can't. Even if he managed to tear up the treaty, which he couldn't, he hasn't got any money because Congress won't fund it. He's going to the Pentagon to try and appropriate funds, but you have to get that through Congress as well. No, I don't think there's going to be the wall that he thinks of, but I think he can build a little bit of concrete, stand in front of it, say mission accomplished, get some malleable figures and persuade the base, you see, I deliver.
Donald Trump, another who'd be well served by reading, well, he'd probably double his lifetime amount of books written by anyone other than himself he's actually read. The excellent book is Divided, Why We're Living in an Age of Walls. Our good friend Tim Marshall is its author. Tim, lovely to chat with you as always.
Thank you.
Marcus, I say time for music. What do you say?
I would totally agree. What do you have for us today?
This is new from Australia's Rolling Blackouts Coastal Fever. It's an air-conditioned man.
An air-conditioned man there by Rolling Blackouts Coastal Fever. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly. Portuguese artist Leonor Antunes is a creative whose focus looks at measuring not only space and time, but how her works fits into a longer continuum with fellow artists and designers.
Her work, characterized by installations that use materials such as leather, wood and rope, is highly site-specific, and her latest event, A Thousand Realities from an Original Mark, opened last week at London's Marion Goodman Gallery. It highlights other artists who've inspired Antunes, including Annie Albers, Mary Martin and Eileen Gray.
Monocle's Tom Hall went down to the gallery to learn more. He began by asking how Leonor arrived at her current mindset for the new works.
I've done a show last year at Whitechapel, so I knew that sometime after that show would finish, I would start to do this exhibition. So I was interested in the gap between when one show and the other one starts in the same city, because I often work site specificity, but relation more regarding, I mean, the works are done in the studio and in workshops. But when I settle things in space, they're very much related to the site. The way I install my work, it's very intuitive and very much thinking the space as something very present in my work. So regarding that exhibition I did at the Whitechapel, there was one piece that I have managed. It was a very big work that kind of was the main starting point of the exhibition, which I ended up not installing in the exhibition because of technical problems, etc. So I kind of developed that other show in a different way as I was expecting to in the beginning. I told Andrew Lice, who is the director of the gallery, that I would like to exhibit this piece here. So it will be kind of a continuation of the Whitechapel exhibition in terms of concept, not so much in formal terms, but more in concept-wise terms.
It's really interesting that you feel that a work from a former exhibition could sort of continue into a new one in a different way like that. Am I thinking of exhibitions in too limited a scope? Do you see it more as a constantly continuing and evolving thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Also, the way my works are conceived are related with that question of like being site-related, but at the same time, the way these sculptures are manufactured have to do with the sculptures are soft, so they can be packed, you know, like rolled or folded, or it's also the very much the idea of the Sculpture de Voyage, which is this sculpture that Duchamp did in the beginning of the 1900s, 1914, 17, something like that. So he made this sculpture called Sculpture de Voyage, or a traveling sculpture, which he made in Argentina, and the idea is that the sculpture can be adapted to different sites, so we would put it in a bag and he will transport it, and the piece was basically done with rubber swimming cups, which were vulcanized together, and they will stretch it in the room, so they kind of like will be integrated in that room. So I think of sculpture as something portable as well. In the past, I did a lot of site-specific works, and I was always very dependent on the space. Since I moved, I think it was after I moved from Portugal. I lived in Portugal when I was younger. When I moved to Berlin, I started thinking that my sculptures needed to travel and needed to be more, you know, adapted to other sites. And so I had this in mind, you know, like when I did my show here, I was thinking, how can this sculpture still be related with that other exhibition, but now it has a different home? I would just have to think of the surroundings of this new home.
And would you be able to talk me through some of the work that we're looking at? Would you be able to tell me what some of it symbolizes? It's sometimes difficult for someone to interpret a work the right way, which is very sort of abstract or symbolic or anything like that. What is it that we're looking at, and what is it that you're hoping that a viewer will take from it?
Well, I don't think there's a right way to see work. That's my way to see it, because I conceived it, so I have a different relation with it than you have it. But in this room, the idea was to open the skylight, so have as much daylight as possible, and not to have any artificial light in this room, the upstairs room. The work changes a lot during the day because in the morning we have this very sharp light which gives a lot of contrast, and now it's kind of everything is more even. So there are a lot of sculptures made of rope and hemp rope, nylon rope. They are installed as groups. So now in the room we have four groups. Some are bigger, some are smaller. They kind of like look very similar because they're all based on Annie Albers drawings. At the end of her life, she started doing prints. She stopped doing weaving work, and she did a lot of prints. And these prints are called knots. So basically, I enlarged these prints. I've been working with her work since a long time. And for me, it was like interesting. In the other exhibition, I didn't relate it so much with Annie Albers, but she was a little bit present, but not as much as here. So what I did here was to enlarge these prints in a scale that I could work, and then copy these drawings as templates and use fragments as templates, and then from these templates, each section of the drawing corresponds to one sculpture, which is entirely made of rope, just rolled rope. So there's like layers. There's one single rope that is suspended in the ceiling. Inside that rope, there is aluminium or a brass tube. And then after, I just start rolling it until I get this diameter.
And what is it about this material specifically that appeals to you? Is it aesthetic? Is it visual? Or is it to do with the feel as you use it? What is it about it that works for you?
Well, for me, rope is kind of, a unit of measure. I often think of this myth of Ariadne, the Greek mythology myth that says that Ariadne was the first architect because she was the one who gave the thesis, the ball of thread, which allowed him to escape the labyrinth so he could kill the Minotaur. And so this idea of thinking the line or the ball of thread has a conceptual device, also as thinking in terms of space, how you can define space with one line, create volume, but always thinking of this as a unit of measure. So, for example, the lines which exist on the roof, which is making these kind of parallel lines where all the sculptures are suspended, are basically entirely made of one piece of rope that goes from one side and finishes in the other. So I think we can see that in the room when we enter, we see the piles of rope hanging on, fixed on the floor. So we understand that this is just one continuous line. And in the space, there are these fragmented pieces of rope which kind of complement each other.
One thing that occurs to me when you see something like rope in a coil, in a pile over there, and then extended into all these different shapes and stuff, is I was interviewing a chef the other day, and he was like, oh, well, people think that my restaurant started in 2012. Oh. He said people think that it just popped out of nowhere there. But when you see the material kind of in a pile there, and then the way that you've used it in different ways and different shapes, you realize that it's, well, an artwork. It begins long before you see it in the exhibition. It begins long before the concept is introduced to the viewer. It's something that sits with the artist for a long time. Do you think that people should see more of the work that goes into an installation like I'm seeing now to understand it, or would you rather people see it just as it's finished, as the piece that they will see when they come in tomorrow when it's finished?
I mean, I don't have this kind of fetishization with work. So I don't mind to see things in process, but I also don't mind that people see the things in process. But what exists in process now, it's not how the work should be. This room is pretty much finished. What we're looking downstairs is very much in process. There's a lot of tables around, which are, you know, it also disturbs the way you look at things and you think that these elements are part of the whole exhibition, but they aren't. So I would prefer to see them separately.
This exhibition, there's a lot of other artist names which are meant to be known by the viewer. Talk me through some of those artists and their work.
So there's a lot of sculptures taken by drawings by Annie Albers. Here there's this screens made of perspex and brass, and the idea is that, you know, if you put all these elements together in one line, you kind of have the whole facade of this house that exists in the countryside. It's this place I visited by the architects Alison and Peter Smithson. It's called the Solar Pavilion. It's an amazing project which I always wanted to visit, because again it was not related with my show in the exhibition of Whitechapel, but the title came, it was a quote by Alison Smithson, and this one as well. I've had this photograph. We end up not using in our catalogue, but I had this photograph in mind of the Smithsons having lunch outside in the Solar Pavilion. So I thought this is like the right time for me to visit the Solar Pavilion and do a sculpture related with that space. It was not their house, it was just, for them, was like a resort for thinking, writing. It's not really a house where you can live, it's very small. I really like the idea that the space is built in an old barn, and so they took the ruins of the barn and they use it as like the main walls of the project, and so they built around it. So it's kind of like objet trouvé as well, like a found object, how they describe it as well. Adding parts, but using a lot of parts which were existing as the main characteristics of this pavilion. They call it the Solar Pavilion. And there is, of course, EVS, thinking about EVS sculptures always. I think this is always present in my work. Also regarding how these sculptures are done. She also used a lot of rope and looping the rope. And then another artist, which is, her name is Mary Martin. She was British from here, which I also did work related to her work at the show of the Whitechapel on that piece, that main piece that exists in the exhibition here downstairs. It's very much related with one of her reliefs, which then I kind of took the proportions and the colors of that piece, but I made these gigantic partitions downstairs.
This is being presented as obviously art, but there is so much kind of design and logistics and influence as well, as we've been talking about, from other artists. Do you see it maybe more like a sort of curation job to infuse your work with all these work of other artists too?
No, I think it's part of my process. I think a lot of things have been done and a lot of people have been forgotten on the way. And I think also my role is to give these persons back to, you know, to the history sometimes. I mean, now Annie Albers, her work is being very recognized, but some years ago, not so many people have heard about Annie Albers or Mary Martin or, you know.
So it's about keeping their work alive as well?
As well, and it's a continuation of what can I add regarding to some works which I find really fulcral and important.
Because there is so much backstory and, you know, the work of other artists, as we've been discussing, do you find it refreshing when people come in and see literally just what is here rather than all of this background knowledge and stuff? Do you find it refreshing when people just come in and say, that's a really cool installation and a really cool thing to do with rope, rather than, or do you want people to understand the history and the lineage of the other artists in there?
I don't think it's possible to see what just exists here, because nothing. There's a lot of things behind, and you know, there's your history, my history, you know, the history of the gallery, the history of this building, the city, you know, the country, etc. It's like it's impossible to just see what we see here. For me, it's not important. Also, because my titles are not so specific. In terms of, like, not specific, but they are not illustrations of, you know, or they don't talk necessarily about what's behind the sculpture. So I hope that the work is not so finished that people can still, you know, fill the holes.
Cool. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Leonor Antunes there in conversation with Tom Hall, and her showcase, A Thousand Realities from an Original Mark, is on at London's Marion Goodman Gallery until the 20th of July. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. The opening theme tune of a big TV hit can help shape its identity and its success. From Dallas to Doctor Who, for some productions, the theme is a more consistent character than the cast members.
But the narrative of a TV show is also shaped by library music, fairly unassuming pieces that are churned out and designed to suit certain moods and often pass by without us really noticing. But if they were gone, we would probably notice that too.
So who are the composers behind these oddly essential little symphonies? Well, author David Hollander has set out to find out. His new book is Unusual Sounds, The Hidden History of Library Music, and I'm delighted to say he joins us on the line now to talk all about it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, David. Good to have you with us. This is a field of art where, yeah, it's sort of strangely hidden, and yet it's very pervasive. It's an interesting almost sort of paradox, really.
Yeah, it's absolutely ubiquitous. Pretty much every TV show, or most every TV show that you watch, uses library music in some form. Some have relied on it more heavily. And then sort of during the explosion of genre filmmaking in the 60s and 70s, it was very widely used in everything from, you know, cop drama to horror and science fiction, as well as porn.
Could you tell us about the roots of library music? How was this kind of genre of music born?
You know, the music really has existed since the 30s, you know, on live radio broadcasts. Records, because it was typically put on record for preview, were literally spun into shows. So there would be like a kind of a live DJ who'd have music there that he would use to sort of inform radio drama and other kinds of radio programming. But, the area of interest that I have sort of been concerned with is the period of the sort of 60s to the 70s. And as I said, that's when, you know, you had this explosion of films being made, low-budget films, that required music and couldn't afford to really make an original score. So the way that it would typically work would be you'd have typically an American production who, in order to circumvent getting music recorded in America, which was largely the cost of that music was controlled by the musicians' unions, they would look to library music, which was at that point almost entirely made in Europe and exported to other places. It was used internally in Europe, but then it was widely used in the US and North America.
David, I think we should listen to some library music now. We're going to hear a clip of a song that's called Survivor. Who has composed it?
This is a German drummer named Klaus Weiss. And Klaus Weiss is best known for being a jazz drummer, and he played in some amazing lineups. But at some point, he started to make library music alone. This is a feature of a lot of library music. Survivor comes from a record called Time Signals, which is just him on drums and electronics.
That's the sound of Survivor. And it's really interesting, isn't it, David, if we reflect on this in more detail, that you can actually get some really kind of experimental avant-garde pieces here. You talk about the fact that a lot of this was born out of, I guess, a financial necessity, or, you know, it was expedient to try and do things on a budget. But actually, again, maybe counterintuitively, it became this astonishing area of experimentation, real innovation as well.
Absolutely. Well, you know, beyond just very simple guidelines given to the composers about what kind of moods a given recording would meant to evoke, composers were really free to do whatever they wanted. And again, at this period of time that I've been looking closely at, it's right around the time of the advent of low-cost analog synthesizers getting in the hands of musicians. So here you have the sort of perfect storm of a synthesizer, you know, a freedom to create whatever you wanted to create within, you know, very, very vague guidelines. And so, in fact, I think that there's quite a bit of material that is, let's say, so experimental that it really didn't necessarily have any chances of being synchronized in a TV show because it's just so out there. And then you additionally have, in certain cases, very famous avant-garde composers who were being asked to make library music, like Bernard Parmigiani.
What was the scale of library music? How many songs would a composer write?
You know, a typical LP, and so these were released in LPs, a single LP would have a given concept behind it, would be 14 tracks. And then the individual libraries themselves could grow to hundreds of volumes, as in the case of KPM, which is a British library. Other libraries, you know, have well over 100 volumes each. Things like Montparnasse 2000, which was the sort of largest French library. And then, of course, there's Sonatone, a German library that also has hundreds of volumes. Let me go on to say that, you know, in certain cases, it would be just a handful of composers, or even maybe one composer, making all of the tracks. I know in the case of Gerhard Narholz, who is the founder and began as the principal composer of Sonatone, there are tens of thousands of compositions attributed to him.
That's quite something. Shall we have another clip, by the way? How much can you tell us about the song that's called Mild Maniac?
You know, one thing I would say is that each of the various countries that produced library music imparted a kind of regional twist. So there's British library music that's distinctly British. There is French library music that's distinctly French. And the same is true with Italy and Germany. This is a song by Peter Patzer, and I would say it has a distinctly German twist to it.
David, it's interesting, isn't it? I guess, can you trace patterns of development and influence maybe from some of these scores into the sort of musical and TV and film production mainstream? And I guess as a sort of corollary to that question, you know, you mentioned the scale of these operations eventually. Presumably they went away from being these niche things that were just done on a budget to being hugely lucrative and profitable in some cases.
Absolutely. Certain libraries, just by virtue of high-profile usage of their music, by the amount of material that they assembled, became really forces. I would say again that a lot of that happens with British libraries like KPM and German libraries like Sonatone. But conversely, there were many libraries that didn't go that route and have since become abandoned, if you will. I've made part of my sort of mission with all this stuff is to actually tracking down and figuring out who, you know, controls the rights to various libraries that are inactive. And at this point, I'm, you know, attempting to bring a bunch of library music from this vintage period back to the fore and make it usable for filmmakers nowadays. You know, there are certain instances in contemporary television or films where library music winds up becoming really foreground. One example would be that there's a two library records on the Themes International label called Drama Suite 1 and Drama Suite 2 by the relatively unknown composer Alan Tew. Alan Tew was a really a big band guy, but he did small group stuff with these two records, which are real unique in the pantheon of library music. And the most recognizable use of that was in The People's Court, the TV show in America.
What you are witnessing is real. The participants are not actors. They are actual litigants with a case pending in a California municipal court. Both parties have agreed to dismiss their court cases and have their dispute settled here in our forum, the People's Court.
Hello, I'm Doug Llewellyn, and welcome to the People's Court.
Additionally, there's music that came from the RCA Italian Library by composers Luciano Michelini and Franco Michelizzi that wound up being the real armature to the show Curb Your Enthusiasm, the Larry David show on HBO. So there's examples where, you know, library music is in your face. The same goes through with the NFL Monday Night Football theme is something that, you know, was originally a piece of British library music and then wound up, you know, in that very high profile context.
David, we have one more song to play. Would you like to introduce the track Fairy Tale to us?
Okay, Fairy Tale is by one of my absolute favorite library composers, a guy named Joel van Drugenbroek. And he was part of a prog rock band called Brain Ticket. And then, post-Brain Ticket, he wound up doing a number of really incredible and really unusual library records on a German label called Color Sound.
That song was called Fairy Tale. David, I was wondering, you talked about some of the higher profile productions where library music was being used, and I would imagine that it was basically the producers wanted to keep that sort of as a secret. Were there ever any coincidences that you would have two well-known shows maybe playing the same tracks and the audience noticing that they've heard these songs elsewhere?
I don't know if they would notice it. I mean, one principal use of library music to this day is for incidental music or what's known as source music. So let's say you have a scene in which there's a radio blaring in the background and they want a country western song or a piece of Muzak. I think that for source usage, oftentimes the same. I know that I have, as a music supervisor, music editor, used the same piece over and over again. So, I mean, in that sense, the music really starts to become what Eric Satie described as wallpaper music.
There you go. Well, it's certainly very beautifully rendered in your book, David, I must say. It's quite the piece of work. It's a beautiful thing to behold and to read, and it contains all of these multitudes of delight. It's called Unusual Sounds, The Hidden History of Library Music, and it's out now on the Anthology Editions imprint. Look out, as I understand it, for an accompanying compilation album of the same name later this year. David, wonderful to speak with you. Thanks very much for being on the programme.
It's my pleasure.
Well, there you have it, Marcus. Edition 465 of the Monocle Weekly bites the dust to a, well, quite a delightful soundtrack. I particularly liked some of David's selections, those sort of moody, behind-the-scenes pieces. You kind of don't really even notice you're hearing them.
Exactly.
At least listen to them forensically, they're actually pretty extraordinary.
Exactly. Absolutely. It was really interesting. Did you, by the way, spot anything from the times when you were watching TV back in the early 1960s?
Marcus is so pleased with his joke there. Marcus, what we should revisit right now is our regular trip behind the glass to thank the people behind the programme, starting with the producer, Tom Hall.
Exactly, and our studio manager, Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Marcus Hippie.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.